And I'm fucking livid that we are stuck in the timeline where Alex Jones is right.
Kind of works.
Oh no! Oh, okay, no.
Why aren't the Amish afraid of COVID? Because they don't have TVs.
As I said, democracy is a system that reinforces authoritarian ideals.
I hope I don't get canceled. Talk to you.
Being a victim of a tragedy doesn't make you an expert in public policy.
Well, I mean, AOC is a drama queen and she's full of shit.
Remember, they lost the Afghan war 10 years ago.
You brought a freaking guillotine.
I said, you don't get to tell us no. We're the state health department. And I said, hell no.
It wasn't making Christianity better. It was making rock worse.
What the fuck do you have on your face, Olivia?
You want to make the world a better place? Have some babies and raise them to not be stupid.
Remember thinking, man, governments are not going to like this shit.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, activists, shitposters, anarchists, libertarians, and people of the internet, thanks for tuning in to another episode of O'Donnell for Liberty. As always, I'm your host, Justin. And before we get started, just remember, whatever platform you listen on, whether YouTube Live, Odyssey, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Anchor, LRN.FM, or if you're listening on the air on the radio, you can help grow the show by commenting, subscribing, and most of all, sharing with your friends. And now, if you enjoy the content, you can join the production team by visiting patreon.com/O'Donnell for Liberty. Again, that's patreon.com/O'Donnell, the number four, Liberty. And always, as always, make sure to check out our sponsors, SneckSwag.com, SneckStore.com as well, alternate link for you to check out all your favorite Liberty merch, including brand new designs for t-shirts, hoodies, stickers, coffee mugs, tote bags, and more. That's SneckSwag.com. Or you can check out the awesome new collection of ungovernable swag today, or get some of your classic favorites to wear your messaging on your sleeve, because nothing spreads liberty more than a conversation started in public. And no better way to do that than just being blatant, being bold, and shopping at SnackSwag.com. If you want to keep in touch between shows, you can follow me on social media and join our community Discord channel where you can chat with other fans of the show at any time. All these links can be found in the description of the video or podcast that you're listening to, as well as on O'Donnell4Liberty.com. So check the description for that link and make sure you give it a visit today. Now, what's the backdrop we're working with today? What's in the news? What's the crazy world we live in becoming? Martial law declared in Canada, the threat of war with Russia diminishing yet being hyped up as mainstream media pounds the drums and demands action by a U.S. government that shouldn't be involved in the first place to defend our allies that aren't under threat. Is it all just a distraction? What's it really distracting us from? Maybe the distraction is the fact that liberty is starting to take a win, that human rights are starting to make a comeback in the American political sphere, as COVID regulations are being dropped one jurisdiction at a time, as people are finally demanding their right, whether with a honk in Ottawa or an angry rant at a school board meeting here in New Hampshire. Finally, authorities are caving to public pressure and lifting mandates and restrictions across the globe, but they're not doing it because of economic impacts. They're not doing it because of developmental hindrances on children. They're not doing it because of the mental health crisis blooming amongst millennials. They're not doing it because of suffering small businesses and the impending economic collapse due to that damage. They're not doing it because of scientific evidence showing the ineffectiveness of mandates. They're doing it because poll numbers are showing it's unpopular. Because popularity is more important than human liberty and societal health and economic well-being to those in power. And when an idea becomes unpopular, it threatens their ability to remain in office and reap the privileges of that power. But tonight's guest isn't amongst those seeking to abuse the power of elected office, but someone who understands the meaning of sacrifice and service, and who aims to bring those values back to governance in the United States House of Representatives. Please welcome to the show, Marine Corps veteran, New Hampshire native, and candidate for U.S. Congress, Julian ACR. Julian, thanks for joining the show tonight. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me. And I got my libation 603 Amber with me.
You're a real dyed-in-the-wool New Hampshire native there, aren't you?
Well, beer is how Marines hydrate.
Hey, I was an 11 Bravo for my whole time myself. I understand that. And if you don't stay hydrated at night, you can't get up for your 10-mile run in the morning, right?
Oh, yes. I'm medically retired, so there will be no 10-mile runs for me for a while. I'm lucky right now, especially with the campaign trail. I got my heavy bag. I got planks. And I got dumbbells. And that's about it.
That's about all you got time for when you're campaigning. Now, I've run for office myself. I ran for Congress in CD2 back in 2018. I ran for U.S. Senate against Gene Shaheen and Corky Messner as a third-party candidate last election, 2020. It was a nightmare. Even with the little like insurgent grassroots campaign that wasn't really picking up much steam, it was a grind, and it was a daily grind just to do the bare minimum necessary. How are you coping with it?
Well, I started in January of 2021, and my goal was to get on the ground and just pound the pavement. And I did everything that voters have asked for decades. I focused more on people, policy, and principles than on fundraising. Because when you start fundraising, you sound like you're fundraising. You actually sound like I sell people, and I don't like selling. I don't like sounding like a used car salesman. Like that sounds wrong to me. So I got down on the ground. I was knocking doors for state rep candidates, special elections, waving signs. I was at the Wyndham voting machine audit and the canvassing for that, knocking doors. I started with election integrity during the Trump administration. I knew some of the people on Trump's Black Advisory Board, so I was basically writing speeches, trying to get them like, hey, you know, lean, all you got to do to win over the Black vote, which Trump was targeting Black men, is provide liberty, because that's the one thing when you live in these major cities you don't get any of.
You don't get much of it anywhere.
Yeah. So my goal was like, hey, Maj Tor is out here trying to get people enfranchised in the Second Amendment, know their rights, and embrace it. And we should be backing him on it, but we're not. So my goal was to get the Trump administration to embrace it. And you know what? When I was talking to my buddy, Pastor Scott's, some of it he was able to get through, some of it he wasn't. We see eye to eye on a lot of things. But the point was there was a moving the ball forward, and it's really weird that I never ever in my life would have expected Trump to be the most libertarian president we had in like 100 years.
It's crazy. It's wild. It's absolutely insane
because I never would have expected that, but the guy cared more about getting shit done and moving the ball forward than he did about all the rest of it.
That too, Ian, like people forget that like running for president as a Republican, this isn't the first time Donald Trump has run for president. And the character of Donald Trump that we all learned to love on The Apprentice and learned to hate at times when he was in the White House, but then I personally fell in love with him on Twitter. It was great. It made the platform worth checking every morning. But that character of Donald Trump wasn't always the person of Donald Trump. And people forget that Donald Trump's first run for president was actually in 2000 when he ran on the Reform Party ticket. And if you go back and listen to some of his speeches from when he was running for the Reform Party nomination, granted, he was still with Roger Stone, and Roger Stone fell off after that. But Donald Trump 2000 speaking, talking about police accountability, about criminal justice reform, about democratization of the ballot, about equal access of political parties and third parties, about reforming electoral standards and reforming the electoral college and bringing representation back to the people. It was brilliant. And it was a very libertarian leaning platform. There were places where he differed and disagreed with libertarians because, of course, he's a big city New Yorker and didn't have everything wrapped up in principles. But it doesn't surprise me that even though he evolved into this character that the media wanted to characterize, that he retained some of that. at all. It doesn't shock me. And I piss a lot of people off, libertarians especially, when I say that up until recently, I used to say Donald Trump was the best president of my lifetime. And that's a really low bar because I'm only 32. The presidents of my lifetime has consisted of two Bushes, a Clinton, Obama, and Trump at that point. So really low bar to be the best.
I'm 34 myself, so I got to agree with you because I was born during Bush Sr., from Reagan to Bush Sr.
Yep. Yeah.
And when I look at Ronald Reagan, I'm like, all right, foreign policy, I liked it. I like peace through strength.
I like what he said.
Yeah.
The difference between Ronald Reagan.
Into wars and stuff. I'm not a big fan of getting into wars. I know being a Marine, people expect, you know, being a veteran, people expect us to be warmongers, but
no,
I don't want my boys to get deployed again. I don't want us to get shot at. I don't want us to get blown up. I don't like seeing my boys with PTSD.
And I'm gonna tell you. As a single issue voter at times, like I have been a single issue voter at times, I understand the single issue voter mentality and how people come to single issue care. And for a long time, my single issue has been the wars. My single issue has been the fact that I have not known a world with America at peace. That in the 32 years of my life, the United States has had troops engaged in combat somewhere on this globe every single day of that life. That America has been at war for over 200 of its 250 years of existence. It is absolutely absurd and it's asinine. And American foreign policy has had such terrible, dramatic, tragic consequences for so much of the rest of the globe as a byproduct of our imperialism and nation building that being an anti-war voter and an anti-war candidate was my single issue for such a long time. And that's what made Donald Trump the best president of my lifetime, is that Donald Trump was the first president in my lifetime to not start a new war.
Yeah. Like, I like the fact that when he came into office, he looked at what we've been doing overseas, and he was like, well, this isn't working, so we're just going to not do it anymore. Which is what baffled me about this current administration. Now, I'd take lots of issues with Joe Biden, specifically because he's been wrong for 50 years. He's been wrong for 50 years by sheer law of numbers. He got one thing right. Like, so when I look at everything that's wrong with how we conduct wars, believe it or not, hearing another person, I'm not going to say who, say that we need politicians on the ground in wars to help run the wars, all I could think of was, so Vietnam, like, we're going to rehash that, like, that, yes, that started our losing streak. I really don't want to get in, like, I don't want to go to war, and I sure as hell, we got to go to war, don't want politicians running it. The best thing to do is to give us a mission, give us our lateral limits, and tell us to get shit done.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think the people who are making the decisions about whether or not war is an acceptable alternative to diplomacy should have somebody who absolutely and utterly knows the terrible tragedy of war in that room and helping make that decision. Yeah. And in 2020, I did not support Donald Trump for re-election. There was a lot of – I outgrew my single-issue phase, and even though he hadn't started a new war, he also failed to end one. And there was a lot of things that I did disagree with him on and a lot of things. But I in no way could support Joe Biden. And in the primary, I actually voted in the Democratic primary because I wanted to see Tulsi Gabbard be the candidate that went up against Donald Trump, because for the first time in my life, there was truly an anti-war candidate who had experience on the ground and had seen firsthand the horrors of war. Whereas up until this point, the only person of real power we've had in these decision-making processes in Senate and congressional leadership who understood the horrors of war was John McCain. And it just turned him into one of the biggest warmongers in history.
Oh, you know why? It's because the military-industrial complex was there.
Wrote a check.
And I got into an argument with supposedly a conservative who tried to tell me that, oh, well, we had to rebuild Germany and Japan after World War II. And I'm like, so
why are we doing it again?
about the military-industrial complex, you quote the exact moment at which we built the modern military-industrial complex was when we decided, hey, we're going to have 20, 30, 40, 50 years of entrenchment in a foreign country and build them up and provide security for them and then try to wield wars against the rest of the world over it. I haven't had somebody make my case so easily in such a long time. It's almost like all I can really do is look at them and go, okay, and
what next?
Like, is that supposed to be an argument?
Yeah, it really is wild because we've seen a world of political division where since Bush started the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War was really a bipartisan effort, but since Bush and Republicans forced the Iraq War down the American people's throats and then Democrats just kind of went along with it for the paycheck they were getting from Raytheon, the American public and the ignorant voter base of the American public has largely seen the conservative right as the pro-war party and the liberal left as the anti-war party, regardless of the fact that Obama started more wars and dropped more bombs than Bush ever did, regardless of the fact that Trump actually reduced the total number of military strikes year over year that Obama did, even though one of his first actions as president was sending a missile strike into Syria unprovoked. But like to say that war is a partisan issue instead of a human rights issue is really the summation of American politics to me. It's ignorance at best and people blaming the other side for the biggest tragedy in our lifetimes.
Well, this is how all governments work, is whenever you give them bread and you give them circus. When you can't give them bread and you can't give them circus, you give them war. There is no easier way to unify a country than to give them a common enemy. And people are like, oh my God, we've never been so divided. That's because we're leaving a war, so we have nothing to unify. Right. There's no common enemy right now.
Well, the war outlived its unification right purpose.
Yeah. So what we need to do right now is provide a goal. And this is something like I was telling you earlier, between the right and or between the, I'll say conservative, supposedly conservative, I'll say Republicans and libertarians, because not every Republican is conservative. So between these conservatives and libertarians or Republicans and libertarians, we have the tendency to make extremely intellectual arguments that go nowhere. And they go nowhere simply because we get so used to discussing this within an echo chamber that we're actually conversing with people who agree with us on 98% of things, which means when we step out on the stage to make the case to, say, independence or the opposite side of the aisle, we fall short because we're making an extremely logical, focused argument to win over, say, our own side further towards liberty, not necessarily starting at the baseline to win over moderate Democrats and independents, where we're just not phrasing it right. Like, from a marketing perspective, if I'm talking to a freedom-oriented individual on the right, I use a different language than I do talking to an independent, or talking to, say, a moderate Democrat to liberal. Like, I use different language because I understand the colloquialisms and marketing and culture do matter. And we, on the entire right side of the spectrum, the liberty-minded side of the spectrum, we forget culture entirely in all of our conversations. So we actually propose legislation way before the culture is even considering it. And it's because we haven't laid the foundational work.
Yeah, and people really, really do not understand the reality that politics is downstream from culture. And if you're not willing to work to affect culture, you're going to have no success affecting the political change and the political will that derives from that culture. Now, something you mentioned earlier, you mentioned Maj Touré earlier, who's someone who does a lot of great cultural work in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, working with Black Guns Matter and trying to change cultural perceptions around gun ownership and inner city youth. And he does fantastic work, and he's attacking the problem where he has the best chance of success, in culture, not in politics. And it's having a political impact. I've heard interviews where you've branded yourself as a solutionary candidate. A solutionary, it's a term Maj uses all the time. I've never been the biggest fan of it. It's kind of like a slingo, like lingoist, but I get it. It's like solution-focused, solutionary candidate, getting shit done and getting shit. But you also, like, you very clearly identify as a Liberty Republican, somebody who, if elected, nobody would be surprised to join the Freedom Caucus or the House Liberty Caucus. And I always ask anybody coming down the Liberty Path line or the Libertarian pipeline, or what was your libertarian moment? And, like, what was your path to liberty like? Because everyone has such a diverse and different path to how they come from the way they were raised, to the way they present their ideas publicly, and to the way they adopt new challenges to their own morals and their own values and their daily lifestyle. Like, is liberty a political manifesto to you, or is liberty a lifestyle and a cultural manifesto? And what was the series of events that prompted you to really go down this road of thinking, this is the impact that needs to be had, here's how I can make it, and these are the rights that I value?
So when it comes to liberty, a good understanding would be, like, my entire family, from slavery to immigration, whether it be Irish, Black, the islands, Italian, all served in the military. Every single generation, both sides of the family. And my parents had this warrior scholar mentality towards raising me, where if there was a book that I wasn't getting in school, they would make me read the book. So I Atlas Shrugged was one of the first books I chose to read. I'll be honest, it was my dad's brainwashing, because we took 12-hour road trips from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, up here to Atkinson, New Hampshire, to visit my grandma, probably I'd say at least two times a year. And that was my dad's favorite book. So between that and Tom Clancy novels, we would ride the entire trip up there, to the point where I had heard the book so many times, I fell in love with the story before I'd even picked it up and could actually read the words. So when I was sitting in class, I'm reading what I had already heard probably at least two dozen times. So going through my teen years, me and my dad used to work in our company, and we'd listen to Rush Limbaugh in the car. And I would even call in at 14 years old to argue with Rush Limbaugh.
Because, right between Jay Severin and Laura Ingraham, right?
No.
Okay. My stepdad, Savage. It was Savage, Ingram, Jay Severin, and Rush Limbaugh. That was my stepdad's afternoon weekdays.
So we never listened to Laura Ingraham. I don't know why my dad was not a fan, but we did listen to. So we listened to Severin, Savage, and Rush Limbaugh, and it would just be a continuous. It was only racial issues that we would argue, that I would call in to argue with them, because I'm like, no, you're missing the cultural aspect, where it doesn't matter how logical your argument is. After a certain point or saying a certain word, your audience, the people you want to win over, have tuned out. So my liberty moment was realizing that Republicans refuse to just engage people at a non-condescending level. And then when I went active duty, I saw the inner workings of how government works firsthand, not just as a kid through speculation. So I saw how our unit budget worked and the use it or lose it spending. I saw all of it, and I saw what type of people get promoted up through the system. Because in the Marine Corps, for enlisted members, it's based off qualification and performance. But for officers, it's entirely different.
Time and service.
Yep. So I would watch officers get promoted based off of time, service, and how good they make their senior officers feel. And when I started to see that, and then I started to relate it to what we have in government, along with all the books that my father gave me, because I started off reading Greek mythology, Roman mythology, Marcus Aurelius, the Medici, and I mean going like Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, all the way through, which is where at Plato is where I was like, all right, collectivism doesn't work at all. It just doesn't work at all. Because at the end of Plato's Republic, he basically debunks the entire theory of collectivism by simply saying it's just not human nature. Doesn't matter how you could force society, it's not human nature. So it collapses as soon as one cog in the machine stops working.
And we're going to get you to read Hoppe's Democracy, the God That Failed. That was the So you touched on something there, kind of in passing, but I think it's a really important thing to circle back on, is kind of the utter failure of conservatives, libertarians, people on the right, and people with more liberty-leaning and logical ideas, people who look at economics as a mathematical formula to understand the truth of it, people who look at human interaction as a summation of economic action and human action, or praxis, as Mises would put it, is logic. Is libertarians, conservatives, people try and argue with logic. They try and defend their points with logic. They try and sell their arguments with logic. And they don't understand that you cannot use logic to convince somebody of your point when they don't actually share your value system. So how do you sell liberty to somebody who doesn't even share your basic value system in valuing those individual rights?
You inspire them. You inspire them. It's the one thing. The reason people turn out in droves for Ronald Reagan and they still say that they're a Ronald Reagan Republican or that they are a Ronald, I hear Ronald Reagan libertarians, which I'm like, he kind of built the police state, but I'll ignore that for the moment. He started
the drug war.
Yeah. So I'm kind of like, all right, so you're a Ronald Reagan guy. Most people, they relate their liberty or their ideals to a moment that changed their perspective. And most of those moments are due to either immense fear or immense inspiration, where somebody made them believe in something. And every president we've had, for the most part, with the exception of George Bush and his father, have been able to do that. So it's hard if you don't look at it from that perspective, that cultural perspective. It's hard to be able to relate liberty to those people if you're used to just making theoretical arguments. Theoretical arguments are great on a collegiate debate stage. Jordan Peterson TED Talk. They don't work when you're speaking to a normal person who is, let's be frank, not classically educated. So a lot of the theory, if you start talking Ludwig von Mises, I always mess up the pronunciation. You start talking Milton Friedman, Thomas Sowell, you start talking Alexis de Tocqueville, so on and so forth, you lose them immediately because they have no clue what you're talking about. But if you relate it to what they deal with at a daily level, like, for instance, the left likes to make mundane activities and mundane things illegal. So say you get pulled over for, you're a black guy in a black neighborhood. You get pulled over for a broken taillight. The cop comes to your vehicle. He profiles you based on the lack of information that the police department works off of. Then he writes you a ticket for the broken tail light. The ticket is $300 to $500. Say, let's just say $500 for argument's sake. The ticket is $500. You can't pay the ticket, so they show up and they impound your vehicle. Or they suspend your license. Next time you go out to the grocery store or to get a baby formula or whatever, they impound your vehicle when the next cop pulls you over because the city has unfunded pension liabilities that they use the police force to rack up fines for. So what you do now is now your vehicle is impounded. You couldn't pay the ticket before because you're poor. They got you again on a basic violation that got you a warning to get it fixed the first time. Then they impound your vehicle. Now you can't get to work. You lost your job. You still have no vehicle. You have a ticket that evolves into a warrant for your arrest after they've impounded your vehicle. Now you're a criminal. Then you go to prison. You go to prison, or I should say jail. Once you've been convicted of any crime, your chances of getting hired drop below 60%. Now you can't get a job. You're relegated to shit jobs for shit pay, and you engage in further illegal activity, which pushes you back into the prison system, and now you get on a recidivism cycle of getting let out, back in, let out, back in, and the criminal activity escalates each time. That is all more government, more government, more government, more government. None of it fits within conservatism. None of it fits within what we're supposed to be doing.
It's the old meme. I think the simplest conservative government story was a meme I saw where a young kid was sitting outside of a grocery store rolling a joint with his friend. And a police officer walks over and says, "Hey, you two, come downtown with me. You can't be doing drugs like that. It's going to ruin your life." And then it says 5 years later, and it's the same guy sitting outside the grocery store, homeless. And the police says, "See, drugs ruined his life." The reality is, it wasn't the drugs that ruined his life. It was the police officer arresting him for a nonviolent crime that ruined his life.
Yeah. I mean, if you're not driving and you're not going out committing a crime against somebody else, I mean, damaging their property, damaging the person, why do you need the police involved?
I mean,
granted, in the Freedom Forum earlier, there was a woman that was mentioning the fact that if you're breathing smoke in someone's face, you're also harming them, their person. And I would say, all right, I understand how that could trickle down, but if you give a reasonable distance, it's not an issue. But it becomes an issue of how can you enforce it?
Maybe you just don't approach me while I'm smoking unless you're wearing a mask. It's your choice. If you want to wear a mask, wear a mask. I'm not telling you have to.
I mean, that's the practical application of laws that everyone forgets. And this is the problem with electing people that don't have real life experience. You can read all the papers and all the theory in the world, but unless you have real life experience that you can apply things in, you're already falling short because your relation of this theory to reality is not there. I could say, hey, in theory, there's smoke floating around in the air. You're harming your.
Hold on. We just lost your mic for a second. You there?
You got me back?
Got you back. Perfect. All right.
In practical application, how do I enforce, say, a 12-foot rule? Do I come over and slam you on the pavement and arrest you? Do I give you a fine? Do I have somebody tattoo a scale across my eyes so I can see the 12 feet? I mean, there's a realistic practical application. Or is it up for interpretation? If it's up for interpretation, it's likely to be abused because interpretation is skewed based on momentary perception. So,
yeah, and it's wild. So I heard somebody, it was actually on TikTok, of all places, TikTok, you know, a great point she made where she said, the purpose of the government is to protect you from criminals. That's the reality. That's like the its purest and simplest form, the protection of life, liberty, and happiness. But the government doesn't protect you from criminals. The government doesn't protect you from crime. The government defines a criminal as somebody who competes with the government in any sector in which it has a monopoly, namely force and violence. So the reality is, if you want to look at things objectively, one of the most egregious violations in recent history, high profile. Of course, there are egregious violations of criminal justice in this country every day. California still uses slave labor in their prisons. New York still has private prisons where people are put in prison for profit and held beyond their terms for profit and objectively abused. But one of the biggest, highest profile, Ross Ulbricht, the creator of Silk Road. And what Silk Road was a decentralized marketplace where people could list things for sale, buy and sell them without a middleman, exchanging cryptocurrency for goods and services. On its surface, that's just eBay. Except because this was without any government regulation, people started selling marijuana and mushrooms and MDMA and LSD and methamphetamines and whatever else they wanted, guns. There was accusations of hitman services and murder for hire being offered, but it was never proven, and it was actually disproven, and the charges were dropped. But Ross Ulbricht was given a double life sentence plus 40 years for the crime of running a website. Not for dealing drugs, not for participating in any criminal enterprise, but for running the website that facilitated the people who were selling and buying drugs. And the reality, when you look at it from a 1,000-foot view, the only thing he actually did was take the violence out of the drug trade.
Mm-hmm.
But the government needed the violence in the drug trade to justify its own policing.
Is it a chicken before the egg sort of thing? Because the origins of the drug war was that drugs were already being traded. So let me focus the drugs to an area which created a growth of crime and organized crime at that, which continued from prohibition era and gambling, and then became the crack epidemic, which created more police, more surveillance, militarized tactics, and then it grew into what you have today with the Silk Road and now a fentanyl and opioid crisis. When you look at the Silk Road issue, isn't that kind of like arresting a landlord because a bunch of drug addicts and drug dealers decide to do a deal on their property?
Sure, but even look at it another way. There are more drugs sold on Facebook and Instagram every day than were ever sold on Silk Road. So why is Mark Zuckerberg not in prison, but Ross Ulbricht is?
Because he's little and nobody makes money off of him. I mean, very, very simply, he's the little guy that is outside the system that no one's making money off of. If every politician was getting massive donations from Silk Road, do you think he would have got arrested?
No.
I mean, if you're connected, whether it be politics, corporations, whatever, if you're connected, do you get arrested?
I mean,
I want to see visually what Ghislaine Maxwell's cell looks like. When you're that kind of connected, I want to see what her cell looks like. Does she sleep on a king bed in the middle of a damn prison? She got the cafeteria to herself. I mean, I'm joking, but I'm
You might not be.
The problem is there is a lack of justice in the system based on how much money you have. And that's really, even if you break down racial stats, you look at people who had and people who didn't. OJ got away with murder.
And wrote a book about it.
Yeah. Mate had tons of interviews about it. And yet still walked around free. It took, 30 years for him to finally be like, all right, I did it. Go ahead. Send me to prison. I got cancer anyways. Who cares?
That's not what he went to prison for.
No.
Yeah, he admitted he did it after Double Jeopardy cleared him so they could never try him again for it after being found not guilty. He lost a civil suit. He owed his wife money and family a bunch of money. What he went to prison for was breaking into somebody's house to steal memorabilia to pay off the lawsuit that he lost for murdering his wife. That's the crazy part. But, no, I mean, there has to be something. You look at, I think we're coming to a head where, like, the internet is now becoming so pervasive and information becoming so readily available and news becoming so decentralized. It's not just Fox and MSNBC, it's Twitter, where it's hard for people to escape the liability for their corruption nowadays. Like 20 years ago, Jeffrey Epstein never would have been arrested. Never mind prison.
We're almost at that Minority Report sort of phase. The funny thing is, the same people now, this is where I still think outside the box and go, the same people who say I don't want the government to have my fingerprints to verify my ballot and shit like that, they have Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and they unlock their phone with either a thumbprint or a facial scan.
Hey.
And I'm sitting here going, wait a minute, do you know that the government gets their data and their information from Google, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, and every other, that, like, that's why the government was like, oh well, you know what, I'm not going to spy on the American citizens anymore. I don't need the NSA spying and everything. So I'll just, hey, Google, will you give me the information?
But they still do. It's not the NSA anymore. It's probably the NSA anymore. We don't know for sure that they've stopped since Snowden narked on them. But the CIA.
They're not as restricted as the CIA is.
Well, the CIA was just, documents were just leaked a couple weeks ago. The CIA has been running a domestic surveillance operation bigger than anything the NSA ever did.
Yep.
So
this is the problem, is in order to deal with most of these issues, the theoretical discussion needs to become a methodology of pairing the two, practical application and the theoretical argument together, in order to attack this stuff in a creative way in which you can look at the technological ramifications and free markets and still try and be like, all right, we need to take the cronyism over here and move it further in the direction of free markets, to which I gotta say, and this is something that we were discussing earlier, conservative libertarian, we screw up the free markets idea because every bill has to be universally free market, no regulation, no nothing. It can never possibly be a incremental step in the right direction, which here in New Hampshire, we just passed a cannabis bill. There are lots of groaning and complaints about the cannabis bill.
From libertarians.
Yeah, from libertarians and constitutional conservatives. I know some of the people who were working on the bill and they were super proud of it because some of them have been activists for 20-30 years in this area, in any moving the ball forward is a win. If people are not getting arrested for possession, I consider it a win. I consider it a win because the way I look at it, if I can limit the amount of police contact we're already moving in the right direction. Because police contact with citizens is statism. If I can limit more interactions between government and citizens, we're moving in the right direction.
So here's how I look at it. And I understand the argument and the theoretical and the principled argument against the bill because regulation is bad. And they're like, well, this regulation, it's not really real. The true liberty and true freedom is to have cannabis regulated the same as tomatoes. Anybody can grow it. Anybody can buy it. Anybody can sell it. You want a farm stand? Go ahead. It's a plant that grows in the dirt and it should have no regulations. And you know what? I agree. I'm 100% on board with those principles and I agree. However, I look at Massachusetts and the way Massachusetts legalized and regulated cannabis a decade and a half ago at this point. It's been forever at this point. It was 2016, actually. It was not quite a full decade ago when they did it. And
it feels like a lifetime.
It feels like it. The big argument at the time was that Massachusetts had an estimated $4 billion a year marijuana black market, and that was the conservative estimate. We think it's about a $4 billion a year black market of cannabis here in Massachusetts. And what we're going to do is we're going to legalize, capture, regulate, and tax that market, and because that tax money is going to help reduce property taxes across the state, and it's going to be a huge boon. And libertarians supported it, and people got mad because tax and regulate's a bad idea. And some of us were like, no, tax and regulate means people don't go to prison for a plant. But beyond that, do you know what actually ended up happening in Massachusetts? They didn't capture a $4 billion a year black market. They successfully captured a $2.5 billion a year tourist and new market. And there is still a $4 billion a year black market in Massachusetts because the other side effect of the bill was to eliminate all consumer risk from the black market. The only risk in the black market now is on provider and supplier, and any consumer who purchases from a dealer has no risk because they're purchasing a legal product that's just not legal to sell. So the possession itself isn't criminalized or penalized. So anybody who had already accepted the risk tolerance of doing business in the black market looked at the new dispensaries and said, fuck those prices, and went back to their dealer in Attleboro or Worcester. And they're still in business, competing with a heavily taxed, and their risk tolerance went down, and their prices went down to compete with the new legal business. So now marijuana is cheaper, more readily available, safer, and it grew an industry that not only provides tax revenue to the state, but anybody who wants to opt out of those taxes because they have the slightest bit of risk tolerance is free to do so. And if there's one thing I know about libertarians, they have a lot of risk tolerance. Like, we do dumb shit all the time to prove a point. So if you want to go buy your cannabis on the black market after this bill passes, guess what? Now you have no risk tolerance and nothing is stopping you from doing it.
See, now if New Hampshire does the same thing, prices continue to go down. Right. There's no sublimation of markets at a local level, which means we're surrounded by Maine, Vermont, in Massachusetts, our
and
price
Montreal, Montreal, and Quebec,
and Montreal. So our prices drop, their prices drop, and it creates a cyclical effect. We can capture an amazing amount, and I'm not big. I don't like taxation. I don't like gun laws. I don't like people telling me what to do, and I don't like the idea of having to choose between eating an edible in being able to own firearms. One, because I'm not giving up my firearms, and it's none of your business what I freaking do in my spare time.
Right, as long as you're not on the road, on the job, or on the clock.
Yeah. If I'm not operating heavy machinery, leave me alone.
I feel that way about everything. But hey, like I said, the principal side of me wants to be able to buy LSD and methamphetamines at CVS. Not that I ever want to do methamphetamines, but like I think about this on a higher level, and I think I sometimes wonder why is the drug trade so violent? Why is there so much violence between drug dealers and customers that necessitates government and police involvement in major inner cities like New York and Chicago and LA and these hubs where it comes into the country like Boston and Seattle? Why is there so much violence? Because people have no recourse. When two dealers have a dispute over sales territory, they can't go to court or arbitration to see who has that sales territory rights. They have to shoot each other. When a customer has a dispute with their dealer because their dealer was dealing tainted product and had fentanyl in it, they can't take them to court and seek recompense for poor quality. There is no method of conflict resolution available to the drug industry. And it is an industry. They don't ever say it's not an industry, but they have no method of conflict resolution. They have no access to courts. They have no access to arbitration. Their only available method of dealing with dispute resolution in the industry is violence.
I agree and I disagree at the same time because it's as much cultural as anything. There is a culture, there is a strongman culture regardless when you're dealing with property in general.
How much of that culture has been incentivized by a generational drug war?
But is it a generational drug war or is it human nature? Because that when it comes to property, violence has been the mode throughout history. Land, property, your persons as property, it all results in violence when somebody perpetrates on that. So whether it be drugs, whether it be land, whether it be your individual self, or say borderlines, it all results in violence. But that's because we have a natural psychological barrier around us. And when you encroach upon that barrier or my ownership of something, which creates another barrier, you've encroached upon my person and you've offended me. And now you can either step back nonviolently or violence is what ensues after the fact. So that happened regardless of whether it's, and you see the very same thing in business. You see these corporate takeovers, they happen the same way. And they get really, really dirty in transactions of lots of money and lawsuits and so on and so forth. But in the non-business world, taking place with serious amounts of money, it's violence. Like, I'm not willing to let anybody come through my front door unannounced. And I'm not going to wait to see what your intentions are after the fact.
No, fair enough. Now, we're running up near the end of the hour, and this has been a great conversation. And there's been one thing I've wanted to bring up and ask you that we never came across, never got to, and it blows my mind we haven't gotten to because it's usually something I'm a stand for. There's one piece of your platform which flies in the face of everything you think a traditional Republican is going to run on. And it's something that I've never seen outside of a progressive left, the Squad, AOC, and hyper-liberals. And that's climate change and environmental regulation. Like, can we talk about your climate change plank in your platform?
So the climate change portion is, I believe, free markets are the way to deal with everything. For the most part, I think libertarianism is the best domestic policy. I don't think it necessarily works in foreign policy because the rest of the world doesn't give a damn about how libertarian we are. But when it comes to climate change, I see climate change as something that the majority of people, regardless of education, regardless of culture, regardless of how many statistics we can rattle off, they see a difference in the climate. And the best way to deal with it is have the government step back and let all these companies compete. Through competition, we get faster innovation. The innovation gets a higher quality, and when it actually hits the market, it's ready to hit the market. It's not supplemented by cronyism.
No, that's a great point. And that, there are
that's my typical thing. Like, I'm not a big fan of taxing and weird green offsets and all sorts of
odd. Green New Deal.
yeah, Green New Deal. It's not real. It's fictitious arguments and a lot of theoretical crap. And I despise theoretical arguments that don't work in reality, especially when they don't work because of laziness. Like, you want to, if we're going to convince people of these out there theoretical arguments, we actually have to win over people first.
Sure. My thing with climate change is someone like, I'm a huge advocate of nuclear energy. I believe nuclear energy is the way forward, and it'll solve a lot of our issues with both energy production, energy costs, and climate change and pollution if we would only talk about it in a reasonable, rational manner and do something wild, crazy, unprecedented, like end fossil fuel subsidies to allow nuclear to compete on an actual open and free market. And I actually think renewable and green energy is a lie that's being sold, because statistically, wind and solar don't offset their own cost of manufacture. They create a larger environmental impact than they save people from. But it blows my mind how unwilling the right is even to talk about climate change or talk about energy independence, aside from subsidized coal and fossil fuel, natural gas, American energy independence. Because the left has made it a lightning rod issue, the right refuses to even have the discussion. And now you see right-leaning and conservative politicians who will openly say climate change doesn't exist, it's not real, we're never talking about it, green energy is a socialist scam. It's not a socialist scam, it just doesn't scale. Taxing it and subsidizing it is a socialist scam, but the government does that to everything else already. And it's a breath of fresh air to see somebody running as a Republican, especially as a liberty-leaning Republican, who's willing to put something in their platform that might turn off a significant number of Republican-based voters, because you're being principled with it.
Well, the goal is to be honest with people. Like, I despise creating coalitions that don't do anything. I despise doing stuff just for a press release. I don't like being controversial just to be controversial because it fundraises. Like, let's be honest, there is a monetary incentive as a public conservative getting canceled, because immediately, if you're a politician, you don't have to fundraise from there on. You get canceled, people just throw money at you just to flip the finger to the left.
Yeah, I've been canceled like three times. The Patreon link is scrolling in the description, everybody. So
I look at, like, if I'm running for office, I have to earn your vote, which means I need to be providing you principles, policy, and I need to be focused on people. Politics comes last. Like, yes, there is strategy to how to get things done, but that needs to come last after you understanding where I'm coming from, me providing an actual solution to the problem, or at least explaining how we can achieve a solution, and me focusing on what we actually deal with. Like, every position I took is literally because I lived these positions. So they're not just theory, they're personal to me, which is why I have such a deep disdain for people who only discuss theory or only engage in formal talking points.
And that's such a breath of fresh air to hear, because it's something nobody ever does, especially in politics. We have people like Bernie Sanders, who's been in office his entire goddamn life and still talks like he understands the struggle of a working man. Or you have people like AOC, who talks about the struggle of being a bartender, even with a six-figure trust fund. People don't understand what it is to live the values that you campaign on, and that's something that I'll find incredibly respectful.
I'll be honest, just to take a shot. We have candidates in my own race who don't have real life experience. Like, I can honestly say, outside of politics, there are three candidates in my race who have life experience. Gilead Town, who is a jeweler, Scott Brown's wife, who is a weatherwoman, and myself, who is a Marine, small business owner, homeland security and anti-terrorism expert, behavioral psychology, and business management expertise. Like, Gail has experience through her marriage with her husband, him being a colonel in the military and the army, and then being not only a senator, but an ambassador. So she's traveled abroad. And then me, I worked a daily job. I was up at 3 o'clock in the morning.
You want to know a little piece of trivia not a lot of people know? Not a lot of people
know. Gilly Town is a jeweler. He owns a jewelry shop. Incredibly nice guy, too.
So here's a weird, crazy little piece of trivia not a lot of people know. Somebody I was good friends with in high school, spent a lot of time with, hung out with all the time, Ayla Brown. Went to school with Scott Brown's daughters and worked for him on most of his state Senate campaigns in Massachusetts when I was growing up. I would not in 100 years vote for his wife.
So I do have,
but that's me as a libertarian. She's a dyed-in-the-wool Republican.
Well, I do have the benefit of being friends with everybody in the race. So I like everybody personally. That doesn't change who I would vote for, because that's completely different. Like I have guys I've served with who are great as enlisted members who would not make good officers. And I have guys I served with that would make better officers than some of our officers. I mean, you either got leadership or you don't. But one of the things that I do like, I drink beers and smoke cigars with Matt Mowers. Tim Baxter's a cool guy. I like cracking jokes with him because we're both very libertarian leaning in general. And then you have Caroline Leavitt, who is a staunch Trump supporter, but I played football with her older brother. I the only person I don't really know personally is Gilly Town.
Hey, well, it's an interesting race in the state as small as New Hampshire, where the candidates all know each other and for federal office. But I do remember vividly as day seeing Republicans in Nashville holding up signs telling Scott Brown to go back to Massachusetts back in the day. So that was a fun thing to see.
Yeah.
But hey, this has been a fun conversation. You've been great. It's been great having you on. Great getting to know you. Looking forward to seeing your race develop. I know I already have my candidate picked in CD2. Unfortunately, I don't even live in CD2, so I can't vote for her. That's Leslie Tang Williams. But I'm looking forward to see how things shape up with you. I know I got to talk to Tim at some point too. And it's going to be fun to watch. Where can everybody follow you?
So Julian, the number 4NH.com, ACR 2022 on Twitter, and Julian ACR for Congress on Facebook. I also have an Instagram, and I have an Instagram and I have a LinkedIn. I try to stay off of most of the other sites because they're unproductive.
Entirely unproductive, but I still spend my entire day on Twitter for some reason. It's been fantastic having you on. Stick around for a minute backstage. I'll get some Zavoria, but thank you so much, and talk to you soon. Everybody else, thank you for tuning in. Thank you for watching. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for following along, and thank you for subscribing. If you haven't subscribed yet, hit that big red subscribe button down below. Make sure you like this content, clip this content, share it with your friends. Visit Julian's website, follow him on Twitter, get to know him. He's running for office, and the least you can do is give him consideration by learning about his views and about his campaign. And that's what we aim to do with everybody who is providing a message of liberty and living the values of liberty through this program. And until next time, be free. Thanks again for tuning in and joining us tonight. Make sure you hit that like button and leave a comment below to let us know your thoughts. If you haven't subscribed, go ahead and hit that big red subscribe button on YouTube and turn on notifications to get alerted every time we go live. If you enjoyed this content, you can join our production team on Patreon by following the link in the description. And don't forget to follow on social media and join our community Discord channel by following the links in the description as well. The best part of all of this is the community that we're building and growing. So go ahead and join us. And thanks once again to our awesome sponsors and patrons for making all of this possible. And if you can't catch the show live, you can always catch it the next day on YouTube, Odyssey, Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, and wherever else you listen to your favorite podcast. So until next time, everybody, be free.